Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. What do you know about hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, of natural gas? Probably depends on who you're listening to. The fossil fuel industry tells you it's the biggest energy development of the century, which promises America energy independence and a huge boost to our economy with benefits to local economies. Many of the communities themselves tell a different story of pollution on the one hand and social disruption on the other. I recommend an article in last February's Harper's, Where Broken Hearts Stand, Grief and Recovery on the Badlands of North Dakota, by Richard Manning, for a look at the spoils of success. And a new book from today's guest, Richard Heinberg, Snake Oil, How a Fracking's Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future, looks at fracking from both economic and environmental perspectives, informed by the most thorough analysis of shale gas and oil drilling data ever undertaken. Stay with us as I try to find out, is fracking the miracle cure-all to our energy ills, or a costly distraction from the necessary work of reducing our fossil fuel dependence? Is it a bridge to an energy future, or a gangplank? Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, and culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Richard Heinberg is the senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and the author of The Party's Over, Oiled War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, Peak Everything, Waking Up to the Century of Declines, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality, and his latest, Snake Oil, How Fracking's Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Welcome again, Richard Heinberg, to Free Forum.
It's good to be talking with you again, Terrence.
Great. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work we talk about. Can you recall any moments or events from your childhood or maybe, you know, high school or college that actually impact the work that you're doing today?
Right. Well, a big one was when I was 21 years old and I read a book called The Limits to Growth. And that was 1972. It was a very controversial book. It said that, it was an effort to use computers to model likely scenarios for how the economy would unfold in the light of population growth, resource depletion, and environmental impacts. And the most likely scenario, the standard run scenario, showed a peak and decline in world industrial output in the early 21st century. And, of course, economists hated that idea. They thought, economic growth can go on forever. So the book was widely panned. But, you know, there's been a retrospective analysis done just in the last few years by Australia's chief government scientific research organization, CSIRO, that concluded that the Limits to Growth study was actually very very close to correctly modeling the data as they've emerged over the past 40 years. Anyway, when I was 21 years old, I read that book, and it changed my life. I realized for the first time that we were on an unsustainable path and that, you know, society was going to have to change in some pretty dramatic ways if we were going to avoid that standard run scenario. And here I am 40 years later, and I basically spent my entire adult life, trying to understand why we're on this path and how we can get off of it toward a more sustainable one.
Yeah, that's the voice of Richard Heinberg. I remember that book as well. Like you, read it when it came out, and I do remember interviewing Danella Meadows a couple of times before she passed away way too early. And one of those interviews, in fact, is just one of my favorites I've ever done. Now, following on that, and before we get into fracking, you wrote an article in July of this year, The Brief Tragic Reign of Consumerism and the Birth of a Happy Alternative. What led you to write that?
Right. Well, you know, a lot of us who are environmentalists get frustrated with consumerism for obvious reasons. But I think most people tend to think of it in two dimensions. You know, it's like, well, advertising is always talking us into using more stuff, and that's bad for the planet, so we should be better people by kind of reining in our consumption, and we'll solve the problem that way. Well, you know, that's true as far as it goes, but consumerism is more than just an individual proclivity that we have to address. It's a system. It's an economic system. And until we understand that, I don't think we're going to be able to do much to change it. It's a system that was put in place in the early 20th century as a result of a huge economic problem called overproduction. With cheap fossil fuels, with cheap energy, we could make stuff faster than people were accustomed to buying it. So the National Association for Manufacturers and other big industrial organizations strategy that involved public relations and advertising. It involved using GDP as the nation's main index of economic health. And basically, we've created a system that depends upon continually increasing per capita consumption in order to stave off collapse. Basically, if we all stopped consuming as much tomorrow, if we all went green and started growing more of our own food and sharing stuff, basically the economy would collapse the way it's set up right now. So it's more than just talking people. It's more than just about talking people into using and consuming and buying less. We have to change the system itself and all of the incentives that are built into that system that almost require us to consume more.
So part of what you're saying there, embedded in what you said when you said that, yes, if people suddenly change their buying habits, the economy would crash and society would feel enormous pain. So what you're saying there is that we've got to take a step back and look at this as an interdependent system and begin to deconstruct and reconstruct that system.
Exactly.
So what is the happy alternative?
Well, you know, GDP, as I mentioned, is the measure that we use for economic success, gross domestic product, basically just how much money is being spent in the economy on an annual basis. And it's a good stand-in for consumption. If GDP is going up, we're generally consuming more of whatever, you know, energy, raw materials, manufactured goods, and so on, because that's what people spend money on. But spending money and using more stuff doesn't actually make people happy. So a good place to start in reining in consumerism is actually changing from GDP to an alternative measure that looks more directly at how people are doing in their lives. You know, how many people are in prison? What's people's educational level? How's our health system doing? Are people actually happy and satisfied with their lives? What's the quality of our communities? You know, can kids play outdoors without their parents having to worry about them? If we start measuring those things, I think we could find ourselves actually making progress in improving our well-being without actually increasing our levels of consumption.
Yeah, I remember Bill McKibben in, was it The Deep Economy?
Yeah.
He actually pointed out that score for happiness, because there is an annual survey of happiness of Americans, peaked sometime, I think, in the mid-50s. And all the consumption and everything that we've done since hasn't contributed to an increase of happiness. In fact, happiness has fallen. And one of his notions in that book is that the loss of community in those same years, consumption, new gadgets, has not been able to make up for.
Right.
What is the transition movement?
Yeah, the transition movement was started in England by a guy named Rob Hopkins, who was a permaculture teacher, And he was concerned about all these issues, and he thought, well, you know, this has got to happen at the community level. We can't just wait for nations and governmental leaders and policymakers to solve all these problems for us, climate change and resource depletion and so on. So he said, what if we start from the community level with people just doing what they can, getting to know their neighbors, getting involved in community food projects, transportation, energy. And the first transition town emerged in Britain, Totnes in Devon. And the idea spread like wildfire. And now there are literally thousands of transition towns or transition communities or initiatives all over the planet, 44 countries, I think about 150 of them here in the U.S. And, it's really saying, well, what if life can be better without fossil fuels? You know, what if the transition that we're undertaking this century, one way or another, whether we like it or not, away from fossil fuels, what if actually life can be better on the other side of that transition? How do we plan for that? How do we make that happen? And so it's a very positive, forward-looking kind of approach or strategy. And, you know, I've just seen nothing but good about it in the last few years.
So in part, when you were describing it, the focus was on how do we transition to an economy and a society that isn't as dependent on fossil fuels, but it sounds like it actually reaches to everything else we were talking about, too, in terms of consumerism and consumption as the highest good and so on, and does that deconstructing, reconstructing we were talking about. Do you have a website for them? Because I should have grabbed one, but I don't.
Oh, let's see. Do I know it right off?
Well, if not, they can probably find it on the Post Carbon Institute's website, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Richard Heinberg, author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. To learn more, go to richardheinberg.com. That's one word, and Heinberg is H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, richardheinberg.com, or postcarbon, one word, postcarbon.org, and that would be the website where you could learn more about the transition movement as well. I mean, it's interesting how what we've done so far in this interview, Richard, is how everyone's promise of plenty perhaps imperils our future, fracking just being a symptom of it. And I'm gonna stick with that just a little bit. What's your take on the sharing economy?
Well, you know, the sharing economy is basically where we came from.
Exactly.
If you look back in economic history, basically where we've come from is a gift economy. That's what that's what everybody experienced back in hunter-gatherer times and before money became a big part of daily life for human beings. And gradually, you know, as economies have developed, we say, or become more complicated and stratified, people have used more money and less sharing. You know, we hire people to do things for us rather than cooperating and sharing. Well, you know, we've taken that about as far as we can go. And this gets back to GDP, by the way, because the more we monetize human interactions, the better it is for GDP. You know, if we all just shared all the time and did things for one another, then the GDP would actually go down. It wouldn't be good for the economy as it's set up right now. So the sharing economy is a great way of getting us back in the direction of happiness, because sharing actually makes us happy, whereas, you know, having these mediated relationships where, you know, everything is a market transaction rather than a gift from friend to friend. You know, that doesn't make us happy. The market transaction doesn't make us happy, whereas the gift does.
Yeah, a couple of references for people who want to learn more about the sharing economy. There's a shareable.com. Shareable, just like it sounds, .com is a website that gathers information about this all over the place. I did an interview with April Renee a few weeks ago on collaborative consumption in the sharing economy. That podcast is available on my website. One thing you said about the gift economy, in David Graeber's big book on debt,
yes,
he actually points out that the model that is taught in almost every elementary economics class, that we went from barter was prevalent,
right,
to, and finally money or shells or something became a stand-in for barter because you didn't happen to have the thing right then. He says that in fact wasn't the case, that the gift economy was much more prevalent than anything like barter.
Yeah. I was so happy to read that. That's a fantastic book. It's a big book. You can learn a lot from reading it. But yeah, if you look in the anthropological literature, what he's saying is absolutely true. There are no examples of barter economies. The only time you see a barter economy is where you have a money economy, money-based economy that breaks down and the money system fails. Then people have to barter because they don't, you know, that's all they have to fall back on. But if you have a healthy traditional economy that hasn't been, you know, destroyed or heavily impacted by you know, the modern civilized world, it's likely to operate mostly on the basis of just, you know, basically mutual indebtedness. Everybody is so indebted to everybody else in ways that can't be counted that nobody even tries to keep track. You know, you just do as the most you can for all the people around you, and you trust that they're going to take care of you when you need it.
Right, and I remember when I was in college and so on, learning both economics and anthropology, how gift economies, the potlatch, that sort of thing, would be pointed out as these quaint aberrations, rather than actually the norm. And I just want to point out another couple of people that talk about this stuff that we're talking about, with the GDP as a poor measure of health of a society. Redefining Progress up in Oakland, redefiningprogress.org, and the late, and I'm sure you knew him as well, Jonathan Rowe, who wrote some wonderful stuff about this. Rowe, R-O-W-E.
Also, there's a great movie that's been produced by the International Society for Ecology and Culture called The Economy of Happiness.
That's new to me. I will look into that. And another documentary that's a little less academic, I assume, The Happy Movie, but also points out very much the same thing. It really looks at what it is that makes people happy. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Richard Heinberg. We're going to get into his book, Snake Oil, How Fracking's Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. But we're kind of setting up the context. I also want to ask you about another book that came out earlier this year that you wrote the introduction for, called Energy, just because I didn't hear much about it when it came out. But if I assume people can still find it. What is that book?
Well, it's a huge photo essay book by a number of authors, including people that will be familiar to most readers, like Amory Lovins and
McKibben, I think, is in there.
Yeah, Bill McKibben I'm blanking right now, but a whole stable of very prominent and skilled writers. And all looking at the question of energy, because energy is central to the 21st century and how we're going to get out of all the problems we're in, whether it's climate change or peak oil, resource depletion, our food system, our transport system, you know, basically all the systems of our lives really boil down to energy and how we get energy and how we use energy. So the book looks at the real costs of energy, and all energy sources have environmental costs, they have financial costs, and they have energy costs. It takes energy to get energy, it takes money to get energy. And you know, even if you're using renewable energy sources like solar and wind, it takes technology and therefore money and energy and all the rest to capture those sources of energy. So building solar panels and wind turbines takes, you know, raw materials and money and energy and incurs environmental compromises along the way. So we wanted to look at all of that in one big book so people could improve their energy literacy, and that's really the goal here.
And so the book the single title is Energy, and they can also find out about that from the Post Carbon Institute?
Absolutely. And there's both the big picture book version, and there's also the reader, which just has the essays. And
very good.
Yeah, that's being used in college classes all around the country.
Okay, that's the voice of Richard Heinberg. His newest book is Snake Oil, and again, we're setting up the conversation about fracking. And to do that right now, I want to talk about peak oil, as you do in the early stages of your book. You and I have talked about peak oil on the show before. What's the current conversation, and you, if you want to go right now into that game that you uses a metaphor of the cornucopians versus the pecus, you may, but sure. What's the current status of the conversation, at least, around peak oil?
Well, you know, for a few years there, it almost seemed as though the basic peak oil notion was being broadly accepted. And the reason, of course, was that world oil production was stalling out and oil prices were soaring. And so people were starting to take this seriously. But then, in the last 3 or 4 years, the oil industry has invested enormously in producing unconventional sources of oil, like tar sands and tight oil from North Dakota and South Texas, using fracking, deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico and off the coast of Brazil, and so on. And that has enabled the industry to increase global crude oil production, not by very much, just a little bit, but it's enough for them to change the conversation. And so there have been, dozens and dozens of articles published in the last year saying peak oil is dead, and what a stupid idea. Whoever believed that in the first place?
Alarmists, conspiracy theorists.
Yes, a bunch of alarmists. You know, I went back and reread my book, The Party's Over, which came out just a decade ago. At the end of 10 years, I thought it was a good time to kind of see what I said back then. And you know, most of that book is based on the work of two veteran petroleum geologists, Colin Campbell and Jean Laherrere. And I looked back at what they were saying, and they said around 2005, 2006, the world's production of regular conventional crude oil will start to stall out and decline. And, yep, that happened. And they went further and said, well, this will cause the price of oil to rise, which it did. And because prices are higher, that will create an incentive for the oil industry to go after unconventional sources of oil. And those unconventional sources, while they are pretty abundant in the Earth's crust, are hard to get out of the ground, more expensive to produce, and so there are constraints in terms of how much and how fast we can produce of that stuff. So they said, including the unconventional sources, we'll probably see a total peak in world crude oil production around 2015, 2016. And, you know, I look at the world oil industry right now, and that's still a perfectly respectable forecast. I think they're going to end up being spot on.
Well, what's also interesting, I think, is that we didn't define the term peak oil, and the term peak oil does not refer to when we have gotten all the oil.
Oh, no,
what it refers
no.
to is when half of the oil has been taken out of the earth. And people might say, well, gee, why would you call that peak? And the reason, as is implied in what you were just saying, is that you get the low-hanging fruit first. You get the cheap energy first. You get the easy-to-get energy first. And what happens at the peak oil moment is you start having to go for more difficult, dirtier, more expensive forms of fossil fuel extraction. And that, fracking is no argument against peak oil. It's an example of it.
Exactly.
So if we're on that forecast, although, as you say, what the fossil fuel spokesmen have done is say the fact that we've found all this new oil, or we're pulling out all this new oil, and we've got these new technologies and so on, shows that, in fact, you know, they don't define the term. They just say peak oil is not there. However, one thing that I found interesting was you said that the official forecast from the U.S. Energy Information Administration is for America's historic oil production decline to resume within this decade.
That's right.
That seems to be the key piece that is left out. In other words, when you hear, or there was that big study, that international study that said that the U.S. might become the leading oil producer in the world again soon, and I think that was one of these things that was that didn't say for a year or five.
Yeah. And you know, I think both those studies, the EIA and the Mowgli report, are highly optimistic in that once the declines commence again later this decade, The EIA shows that production's going to kind of slowly drift back down again over the course of 2, 3, 4 decades, but the data don't support that. If you look at the actual drilling and production data from North Dakota and Texas, they suggest that once we hit peak fracking oil, it's going to decline really, really rapidly. And so, this is a very short-term bubble.
Okay, so let's define now, Richard Heinberg, what fracking and hydraulic fracturing is. And one thing is, I think a lot of people that know a bit about it think of it as only going after natural gas, but it is used for both natural gas and oil. So in your answer to that question, point out what the similarities and differences might be when you use it for different resources.
Right, right. Well, the technology itself is pretty much the same in both cases. And it's been around for a while. It's been developed over the course of decades, at least the hydrofracturing per se. But when we talk about the fracking boom that's happening right now, we're really talking about more than just pumping a lot of water underground to fracture rock. We're also talking about horizontal drilling, drilling an oil well vertically down a kilometer or so and then changing the direction of the drill bit and drilling out horizontally for another kilometer or so, so that there's more contact between the well bore and the oil or gas bearing layer. It also refers to the use of chemicals, slickening agents, and proppants to prop open the pores in the rock once you've pumped all that water down. And it also includes pad drilling several wells from one pad to lower costs. All these technologies have been brought together just in the last decade, and for one reason and one reason only, and that is because oil and gas prices were so high. Regular oil and gas were depleting so fast in the U.S., prices were going up, and that made it cost-effective for small companies that were willing to take on the risk to bring these technologies together and apply them to rock formations that geologists had known about for a long time but thought were just too low quality to ever go after. We're talking about shale gas, gas that's trapped in low permeability, usually shale rocks, and what's called tight oil. Sometimes it's called shale oil. Similarly, oil that's in very, non-permeable, tight reservoirs, and good examples of that are in North Dakota and South Texas. And so this was successful. I mean, they were able to get the oil and gas out and increase U.S. gas and oil production. And for the industry, this is a huge success. This is something that they're trumpeting to the world. We hear and see commercials about America's natural gas all the time and how we have plenty for the next 100 years and so on. What they don't say is that these are the last worst resources that geologists know about in North America, and we've invented better barrel scrapers, but what we're doing in essence is scraping the bottom of the barrel.
And as you point out, both the fracking technology improved since then, improved meaning just that they've found new technologies, new chemicals, and so on. But it's been around a long time. And you say that the maps that said there's oil and gas in some of these spots has been around a long time. What it took was the increase in price.
Right.
So what's interesting again in the positive hype is that if they want to make you feel like the happy days are here again, we're back to where we were. That's never coming back, and that's what's left out. Is yes, we can do it. Yes, we can get this stuff out of the ground or the ocean, but it's going to cost more.
Right. And with oil, that's a big problem because, of course, our entire economy depends upon transportation for trade and just tourism and you name it. And transportation is almost all oil-fueled. So oil is, in many ways, at the very center of our real physical economy. And oil has gotten very expensive. Here's really what it boils down to. If the price of oil were to fall significantly, then a lot of this unconventional stuff would just go away. It wouldn't make economic sense to produce oil from the tar sands in Canada. It wouldn't make economic sense to be fracking for oil in North Dakota or South Texas or Colorado. And we know this because this is basically what happened in the natural gas world. The frackers overproduced, and they were able to overproduce because natural gas is easier to get out of the ground faster than oil. And they did it for economic reasons. They had leased millions of acres of land for shale gas production, and those leases all came with a clause that says, as all drilling leases do, that you have to drill within 3 to 5 years or the lease becomes null and void. Okay, so because they leased so much land so fast, maybe folks will have seen the movie A Promised Land by Matt Damon. It kind of illustrates, you know, how that happens. They had to drill and drill and drill, and so they overproduced, drove the price of natural gas way down below the cost of production. And so all of these companies have been actually losing money with every cubic foot of natural gas that they've produced over the past 2, 3, 4 years. So you see companies like Chesapeake, Devon, Range that specialize in shale gas, they're not making money on production except in a few cases. They're mostly making money on hype, basically by hyping up the value of these leases and then selling them off to other companies like Shell or foreign companies in China and other countries. And that's how they've been staying in business, basically.
I would, and I would imagine if the hype works, it also inflates the stock price, which is another way that one can stay in business.
Exactly.
If the hype stays ahead of what you're actually doing. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Richard Heinberg, author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. You can learn more at richardheinberg.com. That's H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, richardheinberg.com, or postcarbon.org. And postcarbon.org is the site of the Post Carbon Institute, which is where Richard is a fellow, and a lot of very interesting, if this subject interests you, you'll find a lot of other interesting things at the Post Carbon Institute, including information about the transition movement, which we talked about earlier in the program. Let me ask the big question, and then we'll go into more detail. We hear that shale gas and the fossil fuels that are result of fracking is a game changer, that it's going to unlock a whole new layer of cheap energy that will be good for the world and for the U.S. in particular. And is it a game changer or not?
Right. Well, it has been over the very short term. As I've said, you know, U.S. Oil production is up, U.S. natural gas production is at its highest level ever. But this is a very short term. We're talking about a very short game here, if it's a game changer.
If it's a game changer, yes.
Yeah.
So the length of the game has been changed as well.
Right. The reason I say this is that we did a study here at Post Carbon Institute, and the lead author on that study is David Hughes, who had a long career with the Canadian Geological Survey, the equivalent of the U.S. Geological Survey. And he was their senior scientist working with data on fossil fuel reserves and production. So he has a lot of experience in crunching these kinds of numbers. So we purchased the rights to data on nearly 65,000 currently producing oil and gas wells that have been fracked and horizontally drilled in the U.S. We looked at initial production rates, we looked at the production rates over time, and we looked at the geography of where these wells are located. What we found is that in each of the areas that are producing shale gas and tight oil, there are small core regions that are very productive and profitable to drill. Usually a county or two out of an overall play that may be the size of, you know, a state or half a state or two or three states. So the small core areas are productive, but as you get outside of those small core areas, initial production rates are much lower and production declines very rapidly. So taking those things into account and crunching the numbers, it appears to us that U.S. shale gas production is going to begin heading south well before the end of this decade, probably around 2016, 2017, and the same with U.S. tight oil production. So, and also, incidentally, the rate of decline once the peak is hit is likely to be pretty steep. And the reason for that is the decline rates overall for shale gas and tight oil are very high. Now, all oil and gas wells decline in their rate of production over time, but these wells decline spectacularly fast, sometimes 70, 80% and more, even in the first year. So that means that in order to maintain current rates of production, companies have to drill and drill and drill. We're not talking about a few hundred more wells here and there. We're talking about tens of thousands of oil be drilled in the next few years just to maintain current rates of production, never mind increasing. So this is kind of a, in the book I call it a treadmill to hell. And that's what we're on in this country right now with our current energy policy that's really tied to these new technologies of production.
Well, one statistic, shale gas went from 5% of U.S. production in the last 6 years to 45% of U.S. Right. production. That's an enormous shift. And what you're saying is that's where all our chips are, or that's where all our chips are going, and 50% of that is natural gas, 33% of that is oil, and it's a short term game,
right? And part of this is exacerbated by the fact that regular conventional oil and gas production in the U.S. is declining, and in the case of natural gas, it's declining pretty rapidly. So. We're betting the farm on our ability to continue increasing shale gas and tight oil production, but you know, it's to mix metaphors, it's just not in the cards.
Right. Let me ask you the question that I think a lot of people probably want to know, which is what we defined early in the interview what fracking is, what hydraulic fracturing is. But the question then, I think, is how clean, how dangerous is it?
Well, there's been a lot of controversy about the environmental problems associated with fracking. And on one side, you have, for example, Josh Fox and his films about fracking, and which show, you know, people lighting
Gasland,
right?
Yeah.
They show people lighting their water tap on fire, you know, because there's so much methane coming out of the water in their water wells. On the other side of the debate, you have the fossil fuel industry, which is claiming that there's no environmental risk whatsoever, that there's been no documented case of contaminated wells as a result of fracking. Well, the truth is, as far as I've been able to ascertain it, is much more in the direction of what Josh Fox has been portraying in his films. Because, there are enormous problems with water, with fracking. First of all, because it just takes so much water, something like 3-4 million gallons of water per well. And then once you're done with the water, what do you do with it? It not only does it have the chemicals that you've added to it, but now once it's been injected deep underground and then brought back to the surface, it has all kinds of radioactive nuclides and heavy metals and so on that it's picked up from underground. Do you send it off to a water treatment plant? Do you just put it in a containment pond and let it evaporate? Those aren't good options. Well, do you just inject it back underground? In that case, you're taking, you know, perfectly good water out of the hydrological cycle, polluting it, and then taking it out of the hydrological cycle. You know, if you got plenty of fresh water, I guess that maybe makes some kind of sense. But most of this is happening in places like Texas and Colorado and potentially California, where water is a real issue. So that's a huge problem. Then what happens if well casings fail, or if they're improperly cemented, or whatever? Then there can be contact between chemicals or methane and the water table, well water, and so on. And there are documented instances, despite what the industry says, that this has happened. And the EPA has, there was an article in the LA Times just a few weeks ago showing that EPA field scientists had discovered very clear correlations between declining water quality and proximity to fracking operations. But the EPA heads in Washington had suppressed this information. Why? Don't ask me. I don't know. But the data are there that show a connection between fracking and water quality problems. Then there are problems with air quality. The closer you live to fracking, the more you're going to have smells and odors, and people with headaches and nosebleeds and so on. And there are impacts to pets and wildlife and livestock. So all together, you know, the environmental and health impacts from fracking are substantial, and they are worse than with conventional oil and gas drilling, and they're made even worse because so much drilling has to take place in order to produce this stuff.
Okay. I think you left out soil.
Yes.
Tell me about soil.
Well, of course, soil is contaminated by the air pollution and by the water pollution associated with fracking. And so farmers often find that because of the soil pollution and water pollution, they can't stay in business in areas that are being heavily fracked if it's going on next door. So, you know, when the industry talks about the benefits to local economies,
right?
You know, this is something they don't talk about, that existing industries like agriculture are often take a big hit as a result of fracking coming to town. So, yes, there may be some temporary jobs available on the drilling rigs, but that's often offset by existing economies that are incompatible with fracking.
Yeah, and in talking about what happens to communities, that article that I mentioned earlier by Richard Manning in February 2013, Harper's, which I assume you've read, was it was like a horror movie in terms of this is in North Dakota, where the fracking has been, according to, you know, numbers, phenomenally successful, that basically it has turned the communities there into horrors, that if we all, when we talk about, or we sort of use the metaphor of the gold rush, and we know what that means, crazy, panicked people coming and prostitution and gambling and crime and violence and all of these things, that is what's happening. When this gets hot in a certain area, that often is what happens.
Yep, this is what fracking looks like in your hometown.
Yeah. You mentioned methane. Methane is one of the more controversial pieces of this whole equation, because if 3%, if 3%, what's the number? If
roughly 3%, yeah.
If 3% of the gas that you're capturing escapes as methane, it's no longer cost effective to frack.
Question
becomes, how much is actually escaping?
Well, this actually has to do not so much with economics as with climate.
Right.
Because methane is, it has some good things about it and some bad things. One of the good things is that it's cleaner burning than coal. So if we have lots of natural gas all of a sudden, well, we can burn that instead of coal, and that's better for the climate. However, on the other side of the ledger, methane, which is what natural gas is, methane is a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
70 times as powerful,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if much of that natural gas is leaking when you're extracting it out of the ground, if much of it is leaking into the atmosphere, then that can overwhelm any any climate benefit from switching from coal to burning natural gas. Now, yeah, as you say, this is enormously controversial because we've even had some big environmental organizations supporting fracking for natural gas just because of the supposed climate benefit.
Relative to coal.
Relative to coal. So there have been competing studies, that have been funded by the oil and gas industry, unsurprisingly, show that very little of the natural gas escapes into the atmosphere, whereas independent studies, including one by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, have shown relatively large amounts of natural gas escaping into the atmosphere, much more than 3%.
Right.
So where does the truth lie? As far as I can figure out what's going on here is that the industry is studying gas wells that are perfectly drilled and cemented and that are operating exactly as intended. If everything goes exactly right, then very little natural gas escapes into the atmosphere. But if something goes wrong, enormous amounts can escape, and things do go wrong. And if you average it out, which is, I think, what the NOAA study is doing, if you average it out, what you actually see is a pretty significant amount of natural gas escaping into the atmosphere, and therefore the climate benefits really just don't pan out.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I phrased that wrong. Yeah, it's exactly right that you, if you're choosing natural gas as the clean fossil fuel, if 3% of the methane escapes, it's no longer cleaner than coal. And just some studies that have been done in Utah, in Colorado, and in Los Angeles, the estimates of emissions, methane emissions there, are well over 3%, sometimes almost four times as high.
Right.
The other thing is that if the methane escapes through the pipelines, the thousands and thousands of miles of pipelines, which one assumes happens as a matter of course.
Right.
Let me ask, since I brought up pipelines, what is the relationship between fracking and the Keystone XL?
Well, there's no direct relationship. Most of the oil that's intended to flow through the Keystone XL is from the Canadian tar sands up in Alberta. But you know, it's all kind of one system, and as U.S. Oil production outside of North Dakota and South Texas, as that declines, and that means we're more dependent on imports. Now, U.S. oil imports have actually been declining over the past few years as a result of fracking. But, you know, there's still a lot of concern about U.S. energy security, and so that's the big argument in favor of the pipeline. But, you know, people who've studied this closely, come to the conclusion a lot of the oil that will be flowing through that pipeline actually will not ultimately be burned by, you know, American motorists. It's going to refineries on the Gulf Coast, and some of it is likely to be exported because the U.S. actually is a net exporter of refined petroleum products, even though it's a net importer of crude oil.
Right, that you build this pipeline from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, and a good deal of what flows through that pipeline then leaves the Gulf of Mexico to other countries, and I would imagine that the public is not well aware of that particular fact. How much, Richard Heinberg, how much fracking is currently taking place in California and Southern California?
well, currently, relatively little. But the Monterey Shale Formation has been touted as the next big fracking area because supposedly, according to one U.S. government study, there are 15 billion barrels of oil in place that could technically be produced. Now, is that going to happen? It's very doubtful. We're actually in the middle of a study at Post Carbon Institute, again with David Hughes as the lead scientist. much of that 15 billion barrels of oil in place is likely economically recoverable. And the initial indications are a tiny, tiny fraction of that amount. It's partly geology. The formations are highly folded because of the, it's a highly, you know, tectonically active area. And mm-hmm. so you can't drill horizontally into an oil-bearing layer because that layer is so, you know, so fractured and folded. So probably if much production takes place in the Monterey, it's going to be through acidization or acidizing, using hydrofluoric acid to pump underground to break up the rock to release the oil. And, you know, if we've seen environmental problems with regular hydrofracturing, one can only imagine the kinds of risks that we'd be taking by pumping, you know, enormous amounts of acid underground.
Right, and let me just clarify that distinction. Hydrofracking means that the main resource you're using there is water, and then you inject chemicals, certain chemicals, into it to fracture the rock as well, right. In addition to the pressure of the water. In using the acid system, you are just pumping acid in.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, not quite funny, we'll get a couple of more questions, but the California legislature recently passed SB4. It was controversial. Some environmentalists were for it. Some were not. Fran Pavely, my representative, who has always been very good in the environment, was the sponsor. What does it do?
Well, SB4... regulates fracking a bit more tightly than is the case in most other parts of the country, but it doesn't really do what's really necessary. I mean, what we should be doing in California is just calling a halt to the practice.
Well, let me say, there is one of the requirements is that the State Department of Natural Resources conduct an independent, peer-reviewed scientific assessment of fracking.
Right.
And what you're saying is, well, then if that's what you're doing, then do a moratorium until that study's completed. And they didn't do that.
Exactly. And that's what New York State has done. And it's what California should do as well.
Okay. But in lieu of that, so this study, do you have hopes for that study?
Well, we would hope to have input into that study.
Yeah.
And we'll see how that goes. Of course, it largely depends on who's doing the study and who they're listening to.
Yeah, yeah. And let me allow you to leap from this. You've got about 3 more minutes. What should we be doing?
Right. Well, I wrote the book Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future, to highlight how America's energy conversation has changed. Just a few years ago, we were talking about how we're going to get off of fossil fuels because we were so dependent on imports, because fossil fuels are depleting non-renewable resources because burning them changes the climate. So everybody was pretty much on the same page. Even George W. Bush was telling us we're addicted to oil and we got to do something about that. Okay. So the conversation has changed. Suddenly, as a result of fracking, the conversation is about abundance. It's about how, you know, the U.S. is going to displace Saudi Arabia as the world's foremost oil-producing country. It's about how we're going to become energy self-sufficient, about how we have 100 years of cheap natural gas. Now, the data don't support those claims. Nevertheless, the conversation has changed.
Yep.
And that, I think, is extremely dangerous for our energy policy. As a result of fracking, we have an energy policy now of all of the above,
right,
which is basically the same as no energy policy at all. So we have to get back to, you know, serious business here, because we have very little time, in fact, to get off of fossil fuels, and that has to be at the very center of our national energy policy.
So conservation and development of renewables.
Exactly. Yeah, and conservation has to be the real centerpiece, because, you know, in reality, you know, while renewables are going to be able to replace fossil fuels in many instances, they won't be able to do so in all instances. So we need to think differently about how we use energy.
Yeah, and when you pointed out before that our imports are dropping, it isn't just because of fracking and those new technologies. Part of it is conservation. Part of it is economic downturn.
Exactly.
And what we have to do, and California has some great results to show in terms of both conserving water over the last 20, 30 years and conserving energy. And it's just that those things have to be the leading edge, the cutting edge of what we're doing as an energy policy, and then other pieces fall into place.
And it goes beyond energy. It goes into the transportation and our food systems. With transportation, for example, given what we've been talking about, given the reality of peak oil, it makes no sense to be building highways anywhere right now. We should stop all highway building immediately. We have enough highways. We should be building public transportation. We should be finding ways to get people where they need to go using less energy and building our cities so people have to, you know, just need less in the way of transportation. They live closer to where they need to be.
Which returns us to the beginning of our conversation, Richard Heinberg, when we were talking about consumerism.
Yes.
And the transition movement, the sharing economy, and all of those things that really foundational and underlying all of this is how we live and how we try to satisfy our needs. So again, the book is Snake Oil, How Fracking's Promise of Peril and Perils Our Future. A couple of websites to learn more, richardheinberg.com, that's H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, or postcarbon.org. Thank you, Richard Heinberg. Keep up the good work.
It's been a pleasure, Terrence, as always.
Okay. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements, tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and four or five articles of background, email me at my, I mean, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.